I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Philip Pettit, L.S. Rockefeller University Professor of Politics and Human Values at Princeton University. We're discussing his new book, The State, from Princeton University Press. Pettit's research is on moral and political theory and the philosophy of mind and metaphysics, and is the well-known theorist of the neo-Republican theory of non-domination. He is the author of over 20 books and 100 articles. Okay, well, first of all, Philip Pettit, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me, Jeff.
Philip, I love this book. It's an amazing work, very complicated account of the state. Not only is it a sophisticated philosophical account, it also draws in quite a productive way, I think, on some past philosophical works in the canon, putting figures like Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau into dialogue with you, which I found all quite interesting. Looking forward to talking about it. Can I ask you, first of all, to just say a little bit at the beginning about what motivated you to write this book?
Well, I think what motivated me really was thinking about what course to, graduate course or seminar to teach in Princeton, I think about 2017. And I was so shocked, really, in truth, at the very crude sense of what a constitution requires and what a state is that was, you know, apparent in politics at that time, after Trump's entry into politics, that I felt, gosh, we really, you know, this is really worth thinking about, exactly what a state is and what a constitution is in relation to a state, what the relationship of citizens is to a state, and so on. That's what got me thinking about it. And then I realized that in my own normative work, so to speak, and asking about what's required by the ideal of freedom as non-domination, what I think of as a neo-Republican or civic Republican ideal, I realized I've often thought about that too much in the abstract, you know, not taking it that there's a state given, you know, with certain things that are pretty well invariable. We're stuck with them. And asking about how you might improve that or build on that structure to incorporate or to make room for this ideal that I tended to be thinking too much in the abstract. And then I realized, gosh, you know, a lot of theories of justice do that. You know, think about Rawls beginning of, well, now he changes his tack a bit later, but at the beginning of theory of justice, you know, we start with a conception of society as a cooperative venture for mutual benefit. I mean, that is so abstract as a characterization of society. And then we ask, how would we make that society just? And it began to seem to me, you know, we really, that's beginning too far back, you know, that actually we always begin in medias res, you know, we always begin in the middle of things, in the middle of institutions. And we ought to be clear about what, so to speak, is fixed about those institutions, independently of our views about what would make them just, before we actually begin to work out what the requirements of justice, including the requirements of Republican justice, in my sense, so to speak.
Yeah, that's good. I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that relationship between justice and the state at the beginning, because one view that one could have about these things is that there's a certain kind of conception of ideal theory that posits justice. That's one level of analysis. And then on another level of analysis, there's, you could call it theories of institutional design, which you might include things like, you know, how to design a state properly. And that second level, the institutional design level, is instrumental to realizing the sort of higher ideals of justice. I take it from what you just said that that's not the picture that you have, although you do say in the introduction that you think of your account of the state in terms of prudence or how best to realize justice. So you could flesh that out a little bit more.
Well, I've long thought about, say, the Republican theory as a research program. Frank Lovett and I described it as such in an article, I think about 10 years ago now, on the Neo-Republican program, so to speak, a research program. And I always thought about it as a research program where, you know, you set out the basic ideas, they're normative ideas, we're still talking ideal theory. And then in the elaboration of that research program, and of course it has to be the work of many hands and the work of different bodies of expertise, and you work out the institutions and the design of the institutions that might give, exemplify, embody those sorts of ideals. So far, that's more or less common to a lot of approaches to the theory of justice. Okay, I think what I began to realize, and that led me to write this book and to work on these topics, was that actually there's a third, apart from, so to speak, the ideal, and apart from the institutional innovations you're going to introduce to embody that ideal, there's the starting point. And that is, so to speak, the institutions that we think of as institutions that are going to be pretty fixed. I mean, they may be fluid, but at limits, they're pretty fixed. And that's what the state is meant to do, to put in that third factor. Now, when it comes to institutional design, of course, we've always, at least I think all of us have recognized one way or another, that issues of feasibility are just as important as issues of desirability. The ideal will tell you what's desirable. And institutional design, you've got to think about what's feasible. So, for example, what's, say, in the Economist phrase, incentive compatible, the sort of institution that you would expect to survive, in Hume's phrase, even should men prove to be knaves, even if people should, so to speak, not prove to be as virtuous as you might wish them to be. Now, I think that that feasibility theme is also emphasized by the fact that we don't never start from nowhere. We always start from state institutions. So let's get clear about those before we begin to ask about what the ideal of justice we were working with would actually require. And as I say in this book, the idea is that there's to be a companion volume, which Princeton University Press want to publish, which would take you from the state to republic, as in, now we have a sense of the structure of state institutions. Let's see where the republican ideal of justice might begin to, so to speak, be grafted naturally onto those institutions, turning the state into a republic. The press have asked me if I might call the book The Republic. That's the same for the state. But I think we all agreed that is well and truly taken. I do think that the picture I gave you, you know, of we start with an ideal, we look for the institution that would embody the ideal, that's common to a great many approaches within political philosophy, political theory. But I have to say, I do think that political philosophy is too often neglectful of the second part, you know, of looking at the institutions and looking at the feasibility constraints. And someone I really greatly admired and was very, very fond of, Jerry Cohen. Jerry, on occasion, could make it seem like even the institution stuff was just for somebody else. It was sort of, we philosophers just thought about the abstract theories of justice. And that seems to be a really bad mistake. You know, that's at the very other extreme from the way I want to think about the theory of justice, its connection with the starting point in institutions of the state and its development in a form of institutional design thinking that takes account of feasibility constraints.
Right. Yeah. And I was thinking in terms of the, you could say, the realist critique associated with Bernard Williams against the kind of ideal theory. It seems like at least this approach has some kind of connection with that and thinking about that practicability is like an important normative value, not just the other, you know, normative values in any kind of ideal theory, that this has to be part of any theory.
That's very interesting, because actually I was well embarked on the project. In fact, almost near completion, I think, when I, though I'd written about political realism and political theory and a bit about Williams in particular, when I realized that's exactly what I'm doing here, I'm doing the sort of thing that Bernard Williams thought it was so important that we do. Now, there's one interesting sort of difference. Well, there are many differences, but one interesting difference between the approach that I favor and that which Williams himself endorses is the following, if I may mention that at this point. Williams says that, well, of course, we should be looking at what's required of the state, you know, in the real world, so to speak. But he does limit, of course, the regimes that he's prepared to regard as the states that are worth looking at. And he limits them to states that satisfy what he calls the basic legitimacy demand, right? Which is that people should be able to have justification given to them for the form of which the state is assuming. Now, I think that's too strong. That's actually too idealistic in a way. That's already requiring that the state has gone a long way, it seems to me, towards the ideal of justice. So in this book, I agree absolutely with Williams in asking about what the state allows, what the state requires, its institutions and so on. We can't just look at anything that has ever passed as a state in the history of our species. After all, as Rousseau put it, for example, a state, whatever it is something different from a reign of terror. And I do think there's a real distinction there. And the way I draw it in the book is this, that the regimes in which I think are worthy of the name of a state, probably a much wider set than the set that would pass Williams's test, are this the set of regimes in which there is at least a rough balance of power between those who rule and at least some of those who are ruled. Now, that allows you to think that a regime counts as a state, even if it's only a minority or of those who are ruled who have that sort of counter power against those who are ruled. So, you know, the Norman state of, you know, 13th century Britain, for example, the only citizens in really my sense of the term who really have a power in relation to those who rule over them are, well, probably the barons, you know, who made the, who signed up the, to the Magna Carta or forced King John to sign up to the Magna Carta. But that was clearly a state. And I want to be fairly accommodating in allowing states to be of that really highly unjust kind.
That's good. Yeah. And I was wondering, so sort of on this point, it was, you know, it's interesting that you, you know, define the state, at least at we'll get into your kind of functional genealogical account of the state in a second. But, you know, on this point of the state as a kind of, you know, balance of power between rulers and ruled. But one thing I was wondering about is why not think of the state instead as understood as, in kind of teleological terms, that its end is the common good. I mean, I assume that would be another way of thinking about it. Sometimes with my students, I, you know, envision, you know, what's the difference between government and the mafia, right? This is some, you know, example that sometimes comes up in libertarian thinking. You know, the mafia and the government also, you know, both provide protection for the citizen, for their members in their particular area. They extract resources from. So what's the real difference? And it seems one way, at least, to define the difference is that the purpose of the institution is set up to benefit the people as opposed to the rulers.
Yes, I still find that just a little bit too idealistic for my purposes.
Uh-huh, okay.
It's a sort of approach you find very much in medieval thinkers, you know, where, and of course that's following Aristotle really, where, you know, a regime can be, can involve an absolute monarchy or it can involve a democracy and it counts properly as legitimate or you might say properly a state, so long as those who rule in the name of the common good, not just for their private interest. Trouble with that is very hard to say, you know, what the motives are of those who rule, for example, which that seems to direct us to. I think a better, as we're heuristic for identifying states where there is the sort of balance I'm talking about, and where there is what we're prepared to regard as a state, however unjust, still a proper state, is the following. Think about those who are ruled. They're certainly going to have a motive for obeying the law, going along with the framework in place, which consists in the fact that those who rule them will almost certainly punish them if they break the law and so on, disobey the law and don't follow the ruler. That's fine, and that's probably true in every regime imaginable, really. But here's the thing. In some regimes, even regimes which are really unjust, it's still going to be the case that there's something about the institutions in place and the shape they assume, which means that those who are ruled needn't be going along with that framework just for fear of punishment. There must be some features about that framework that makes it independently attractive to them. Now, those could be very minimal features, such as, for example, it's just enabling them to coordinate with one another, forming mutual expectations to which others, to which they actually live up. It could be as weak as that. But it's when you get, so to speak, features of a regime that make it, that render it, give people a motive for going along that is independent of just the fear of punishment. That's when you don't have a reign of terror. That's when you do have something deserving to be a state. Now, I suspect that North Korea, I don't know enough about it, doesn't count as a state in that sense. But certainly, for example, other regimes that we might decry in all sorts of ways do count as states by that criteria.
Right.
I mean, contemporary regimes.
Yeah, Kant talked about the freedom of the pen as a kind of, you know, intrinsic feature of any rightful constitution, right? That anything short, you know, if you don't have the freedom to raise objections to a state, this doesn't count as a condition of right, because you're not able to exercise any freedom. I mean, but Kant thought that, you know, freedom of the pen was also compatible with a kind of, you know, authoritarian forms of government. It's just those forms of government that then would allow for the people to raise objections and so forth.
You're much more of a Kant scholar than I am. I know the Kant stuff reasonably well, but not at the level of your expertise. But my sense is that, we both agree, I'm sure, that Kant thinks there's something as something like an acceptable or proper regime, a state, very much in the Rousseau thinks, not a reign of terror. But he thinks that the sort of republic that he looks for, not every state can be in that sense as justified as that or as attractive as that. And as we know, he allows a state to count as a state even when there is a wholly tyrannical ruler in place. Now, it's an interesting question. I don't read Kant as thinking that the freedom of the pen, which after all is not a great freedom, but sort of saying, dear sovereign, of course you are absolutely incredibly likely to be right and don't in any way need to challenge you, but perhaps you would think about the following. I mean, that's allowed, and that's about all that's allowed. But even that, it seems to me, as I read Kant, is pushing towards, you know, justice or the republic proper. It's not a precondition of a regime actually counting as a state.
I see. So you're actually more stringent than Kant on your view as to what counts as a state.
Yeah, in a way, I'm less stringent. I mean, I think I probably would allow more regimes count as states, because I too think that a state can be a state proper in my sense, and yet be ruled autarkically by an autocrat, provided, so to speak, the structures of law and so on set up and maintained by the autocrat have a feature that makes them independently attractive to those who are ruled. Now, of course, I did say that the ruled must have some degree of power, balance of power. But of course, that varies a lot. But clearly, they must have enough power so that did the autocrat begin to change the framework or apply it in a way that really lost whatever independent appeal it had for those who were ruled, then I take it that they would reject that. There would cease to be a state at that point. I mean, they would resent it at any rate.
Yeah, so let's talk about your genealogical account of the state that which is where you begin. I do love your approach to examining, analyzing the state, which is a kind of functionalist account with its heritage, I assume, in Aristotle, which is the, say, thinking about what the telos or the purpose of an institution is by reference to thinking about how it came to be and for what purpose it was introduced. It's also, there's a heritage in your thinking, it seems to me, with the state of nature thinkers from the early modern period, whom you reference at a couple places. That is, I mean, roughly speaking, it seems to me the way you approach is, and tell me if I'm wrong in thinking of this way, but is to think about the condition of the state of nature among human beings, and then think about what the kinds of problems are that they face, what Locke calls the inconveniences of the state of nature, and hence what then the functions of the state are that would be introduced to remedy those sorts of problems. Is that the right way to think about it in terms of, kind of Aristotelian up through the state of nature tradition? And then maybe we can kind of, you can give us a kind of overall sketch of the of your genealogical account.
Okay, well, first of all, let me say I'm greatly relieved that you do like the genealogical account, because I really struggled with whether or not I should use that. But I mean, here's the choice that I faced, and anyone undertaking this sort of work will face, which is if you're going to write about the state as such, not about justice, just about the state as such, you have to start off with some characterization of what makes a state a state, what makes a system of rule into something deserving the word state. Now, you could do that definitionally, and I did think, or stipulatively, by simply saying, well, I'm going to take a state to be a regime, of force, of that involves force and so coercion, that is dedicated to following ends. And then it seemed to me, well, that seems very stipulative, you can get off the bus very easily at that point and say, I have no interest in this book from now on. And I really racked my brains about how you might do this. And then I thought of Herbert Hart on the concept of law, the book that he wrote published in the 1960s, where he says, well, rather than asking, what's the function of law? What is it that makes a system a legal system? He goes in for what I call, Bernard Williams calls, another debt to Williams here, really, a counterfactual genealogy or a conceptual genealogy, or there's a book now published by Matthew Killers on genealogy in general, which has come to be a method in philosophy. And I don't mean genealogy in the Foucault sense, which is more historical, but in the counterfactual sense. And Hart is a good example where he says, imagine a society without any laws. And then he identifies problems that these people would have in that society. And then he talks about how solutions to those problems would emerge, so to speak, really behind people's backs almost, in an unplanned way. And then having traced those and persuaded you that that would happen, he says, now, isn't this a legal system? And then says, well, now, why did that system emerge in this piecemeal unplanned way that I've described? The answer to that question as to why it would emerge in that society, if the society is like enough to our society in other respects, will point you to a function of the law, the system of law, as in something, the rationale, as you might say, of a system of law. That's exactly his method in that book. And I thought, well, why not use the same method here? And so the first chapter of the book is designed really to generate or support an account of the role or function of the state on those grounds. And the function, you know, I come up with, as I say at the beginning, I think of that chapter, starting maybe in the introduction, readers who find this obvious need not read this chapter. You know, they may continue to the rest of the book. So the function I do, as you know, assign in that chapter is that the state is a system. It's essentially a nomothetic system. It's territorial and it's coercive, and its function is that of establishing a system of law in broadly, actually, Hart's terms. And the chapter consists in a story about problems that would emerge, giving rise to conventions. I use David Luce's work there, giving rise to norms. I use the work of various people, including work of my own in the past, on how norms might emerge, norms which, unlike conventions, tempt free riding, right? And then argue about how laws would appear on the basis of norms, using, in a way, shamelessly, the Hart type argument there. And then I argue, going beyond the system of law that Hart explains why would emerge, I say, well, now we put in place various conditions, such as, for example, that people are likely, under rule of law, to escape punishment by just leaving the area, so to speak, going away, becoming outsiders, outlaws, or whatever. Well, that argues for making the law, for having a territorial aspect to the law. And again, coercively, people, there may be good reasons in the economy of esteem, as I like to call it, why people might go along with norms and the law, but they'll often prove ineffective. And so you might expect the state to become coercive. So that's how I generate the story of the state. But if I can, I'm taking too long on this issue, I realize, but if I can address the point you made about the connection with the Lockean tradition and in general the contractualist condition tradition. Big difference, I would say, there, although it certainly continues of that tradition, of course. The big difference as I see it, and this may mark a difference with Williams as well, actually, is that mine is an emergentist story. It's a story about how, as I put it, it would be robustly likely that people like us, in conditions otherwise like ours, would respond to such and such problems in this or that way, and then tell a story about how these responses, these adjustments, will aggregate to create an effect, you know, in an unplanned way. And then when you see that you really would likely have the development of something that answers to roughly our sense of a state in such a world, you can ask, well, why did that emerge? What function was it serving? And that gives you at least a candidate for the role of the function or the role of the state. And that's why that first chapter is important to me. But as I say, if that's an obvious lesson, that story about the function of the state, at the end of the first chapter, then you needn't read that chapter at all, you know? Mm-hmm. I'll just make one more comment about that emergent story. It's very like the story that economists traditionally tell about money. You know, you ask an economist, what is money? And they will say, well, imagine a counterfactual society where there's barter or whatever. And then they tell you the whole series of stages about the problems, the unplanned adjustments that are very likely, robustly likely, meaning likely across a whole range of contingencies, robustly likely to emerge. And then they say, now, wouldn't that count as money? And doesn't it tell us something about the function of money as a means of exchange, a metric of price, and so on? Of course, lots of people now love to, David Graeber and others, criticize that economic theory on the grounds that's not actually how it emerged. That doesn't worry me, how the state emerged or how money emerged. The idea of the counterfactual genealogy is that it tells you about a world like ours, at any rate, whether historically it answers to ours is another question. And it uses that little model, that thought experiment, to identify what plausibly is a function of the institution you're analyzing, money or the state or law or whatever.
Yeah,
I did like this, although let me try to see think of you know, an objection to it. I was thinking about this one in particular, that yeah, there are many sorts of genealogies, I suppose, that one could make of the emergence of the state. Here's one, and I wonder what you think about it. It often comes from a kind of progressive way of thinking about the state, although I suppose kind of libertarians might think of this similar ways, which is that, you know, the state emerges as a way of giving additional power and force of domination to, you know, dominant groups in society over less powerful groups in society. You know, that it's not, the state is not a kind of, you know, a legal system in the sense that its laws are broadly beneficial, but it's actually an institution to increase the dominance of one group over another. You know, how would you respond to that kind of account, which, you know, of course, are you seeing somebody like Rousseau and the Discourse on Inequality, how the rich, you know, yes, pull one over on the poor, yes, for yes, example, and that's what, yes, the state is just laws giving additional power to that kind of group. How do you think about those kinds of genealogical accounts?
Well, remember, in my genealogy, I'm quite prepared to imagine in the genealogy that not everybody is equal, that it's a stratified society, for example. And I say, well, here's how I'm going to think about that scenario, which is, it's only those at the top, so to speak, who now count as they will become when the state emerges, as the citizens. And the others are really subordinate to them in various ways, maybe as slaves, maybe as women in, you know, very sexist society, and are not properly citizens. As was, let's face it, historically the case for maybe most states that have emerged in the last, 4,000 or 5,000 years. So I'm prepared to think that the genealogy isn't idealistic in setting that aside. However, where it differs from the scenario, you might say, well, here's my genealogy. I think the state emerged because, think of any world of this kind, you know, stratified or not, there's always going to be one group among even the most privileged who want power over the others, you know, and the state's going to emerge as the way in which they achieve power. That would certainly be a genealogy of a reign of terror, but it wouldn't explain. So I do assume in the genealogy that in at least this topmost sector, there is a degree of equality of power amongst those in that sector. And that means that whatever emerges has to emerge under that assumption. There has to be a story of robustly likely emergence against the background of that assumption. The assumption that one group is just seeking power over others is not going to give you anything that will stand apart from the reign of terror, for example. It's just as likely to lead to that as it is to something that I would call a state. But these are, I agree, you know, the thing is, I look forward to, I hope that others may be motivated by this model I've described to come up with other models of genealogy that that fits with my assumptions. But this is my baby. It's the one I like, you know, at the moment. But I do stress that it's very important in any emergentist story, which this is, that there's no luck or fortuity. That's why I say it's robust likelihood, a likelihood under a whole range of circumstances. So someone tells you, oh, well, I think the state began, some genius must have emerged and said, listen, guys, we can make a social contract. And it worked, you know. Well, you know, that's a just-so story. That's not a counterfactual genealogy. And it really isn't likely to tell you anything about the function of a state. But if you can say there's a robust likelihood to the emergence of this sort of institution under these conditions that really do correspond to conditions historically that have obtained in our species and among creatures pretty well like us. And it's robustly likely that this would have emerged, you know? And what would have emerged in your story looks pretty well like a state, you know? Then that immediately gives you a heuristic for identifying a potential function for the state. It'll be those effects for which it robustly probably emerged in that counterfactual world.
Right. And you move from the genealogical account to from identifying what the function is to an analysis of how should the state or how can the state better and realize its function and realize its function in a worse sort of way. You discuss the sort of the question of how centralized government agency should be. And this is a question that puts you in dialogue with the early modern sovereignty tradition of Baudin and Hobbes. Yes. And it draws on some of your own work on thinking about group agency and so forth. So maybe you could give us the broad sketch of why should we think about the state function as best fulfilled in terms of a kind of single form of group agency rather than a kind of fragmented way of thinking about state power.
But maybe just before doing that, I should mm-hmm. mention that the rest of the book. I look first at, so to speak, how might the state be improved in order to satisfy its function more reliably? That's not looking at justice as such. That's just looking at a functional ideal. But then the second thing I look at is, does this function impose various limitations that have often been alleged on a state, so to speak? And I argue that against a set of limitations. But putting that aside, at least for the moment, mm-hmm. back to what the function, so to speak, requires. And I argue in a way, a very, on the one hand, on the other hand, sort of, I run an argument of that kind on this question. On the one hand, I want to argue that if the state is going to function optimally in its own terms, as we've described it, then it had better guard against, it had better operate as a single agent, so to speak, so that there is a single voice behind the law. The law is not incoherent. There's a single voice in dictating what various people in the state must do, not just in obeying the law, but in assuming various posts that might be ascribed to them. You know, it might be sitting on juries, for example. There has to be a degree of unity in how the law and policy and so on go together, else the thing is going to fall apart. And I associate that with treating the state as a group agent. Just to back off a little bit from that, or go back a little bit, I think of an agent as any system that pursues certain goals, has certain goals, and it pursues them across different varying scenarios. It's able to adjust to different scenarios so as to adopt actions that actually further those goals in those different scenarios. That's what an agent is. Now, a group agent is when a number of people are so coordinated with one another that they unite, at least in a certain domain of action, so as to pursue common goals and to pursue them across varying situations according to commonly endorsed representations of the features of those situations. And I think a state does exactly that as it pursues various goals in dealing with, you know, an uprising there, this law breaking over there, this invasion by perhaps another state, you know, whatever it might be. And it does, ideally, it has to do that pretty coherently, or else it'll just dissolve into a set of competing regimes, so to speak. So in that I think it's the second chapter of the book where I talk about this element. This goes very much on the face of it with Hobbes and with the sovereigntist, you know, that there has to be this assumption of creation of unity. And the two examples I give, it requires, that there are no rogue agencies within the state. I mean, if the police or the army are a rogue agency, acting, so to speak, as a law unto themselves, then the state is not going to function well. So rogue agencies, ideally, I don't talk about how this can be done, but ideally will be brought together in a functional state. I mean, will be contained. But equally, I think there has to be what I describe and characterize in a slightly novel way as a rule of law within that system, meaning that in particular, that different agencies, judicial agencies versus administrative versus legislative, have to, so to speak, come to a single mind of what the law is, rather than it's going to function better as a state to the extent to which the law is coherent. So that's the strong, so to speak, argument for having a state that is unified as an agent. And then that leads into the third chapter, which is, well, wait a moment, you know. And now we are looking, it seems, at the Hobbesian specter, you know, of a tyrannical sort of sovereign. And I argue that there is good reason also, from the point of view of those who are ruled in such a world, to guard against those at the center of this now centralized state, as you described it, to guard against them using the state for their own purposes, using the state for sectarian ends, you know, basically usurping the power that's been given to the state in the name of its being a functional entity. And I suggest that as against that usurpation, there's going to be deep reason why there should be, the Republican tradition, he called it a mixed constitution, or we know it as a separation of powers, although I think we have to say a separation and a sharing of powers, because, of course, the legislative power is shared between different houses of parliament, judicial power is shared between courts and a hierarchy of appeal and so on. Administrative power is shared across all sorts of agencies, including those that are given relative independence. I mean, in the states we know, I think there's good reason of a functional kind for that sort of separation and sharing of power. And of course, that then chapter leads into a discussion of what are Hobbes's arguments, Bodin's arguments for sovereignty, and how far can they be accommodated with the picture of a separation of powers. And actually, if I could, I quite like the line that I come up with in that chapter. I don't know if I was going to appeal to other people, but that I think there is a quite neat solution. We might or might you might or might not want to talk about that to that problem.
Yeah, well, I was curious about how it does seem at first a little bit like, you know, squaring the circle in the sense of,
yes,
you know,
exactly,
combining a unified sovereign with what you call a polycentric constitution.
Exactly.
But it seems to me to rely on, and I think that this is your solution, which is to think in terms of, on the one hand, thinking about group agency as realized through a common understanding of a legal system, but then thinking about that there are multiple ways to interpret how to execute that legal system, right? So, you know, different, for example, in the United States, I mean, we have a sort of federal system. The federal government can have one conception about how to carry out the law. And, you know, I live in Texas. Texas is always complaining about the federal government, how it gets it wrong. So that creates a kind of a tension. But it's not as if, although maybe there are limit cases here where Texas would actually just sort of disagree wholly with the interpretation of the law. You saw this in the early Civil War, where you'd have kind of nullifications on the part of state. I'm assuming that sort of state nullification of federal laws would be, breach that kind of demand for state power. So is that, I guess, Is that the right way to think about it in terms of, you know, a sort of commonality of thinking about, you know, understanding the legal system and its fundamental principles, but then different interpretations on how to execute or carry out that law?
Well, group agents come in many, many varieties. And some group agents can be obviously very well organized, and there's very little tension. There's very little, as were grit or friction in the work, so to speak. But other group agents, consistently with being a group agent, with there still being a set of goals advanced over time, more or less coherently and with a single voice and so on, single direction. Consistently with that, it can be an extremely friction-heavy sort of organization. Now, I would have said that the United States at the moment is at the very end of that spectrum of how frictional, sorry, that's not the word, but how friction-heavy can you become and yet remain a single agent? Mm. And of course, that's what happened with the Civil War. You actually, it did break down, and that just means you go to war, or you establish quite separate sorts of entities, you break up. But consistently with remaining still a group agent, a system can be quite internally, involve elements internally at loggerheads with one another. Can I use a simple, you know, to pull away from politics and make it, and I use it in the book a lot, a simple analogy with, and you'll remember this, Gilbert Ryle, in a book in the Philosophy of Mind, tells a story about the visitor who comes to Oxford. This is Oxford, at least of the 1940s and 50s, late 40s, and asks to be shown around. And he's shown around all 29 colleges, I think there were at the time, or whatever it is, and likes all of them. He said, "Well, that's terrific. Now, I've seen the colleges. Can you show me the university?" And, you know, Ryle calls this a category mistake, because, of course, the university just is the colleges under a different name. The colleges, insofar as they coordinate with one another, they do a lot of quarreling as well about the terms on which students are admitted, about the sorts of courses that are taught, about how they're assessed and examined and graded, about what they've got to do, the students, in order to actually achieve to graduate, about who's going to be employed and who's going to be given different jobs. And, you know, there's always been friction, imagine, in an institution like that over history, in how those colleges interact. But they still manage to stay alive, you know, as a corporate agent. Now, you ask, who's the boss in Oxford? Who's the sovereign, as it were, in Oxford? And the sovereign clearly is the university. And the university is, it's not something that's coordinate with the colleges. It's something that's superordinate to the colleges. It's something that the colleges create insofar as they relate to one another in various ways. Where relating to one another means coordinating, but often it also means going into conflict. Okay, now I think that the answer to the Hobbesian question, before I come back to the United States, is that you can have a system of lawmaking and law implementation and imposition and so on, territorial, coercive, and the lot, that involves quite separate agencies that have to relate to one another, and often that are in conflict with one another, like, for example, two houses of a legislature that are in tension with one another a lot of the time. But there's enough agreement around and there's enough coordination around to mean that what eventually emerges as the law, for example, or eventually emerges as agreed policy, you know, is a single, more or less coherent set of system of law and a coherent set of policies that may change over time and so on. At any time, there may always be friction in the works. But I think the sovereign, just as the sovereign in Oxford is the university, superordinate entity, the sovereign in a state with different agencies isn't the legislature or isn't the courts or isn't the administration. It's simply the entity they come together to constitute. It's the state. And of course, if the state does involve the people, as it were, deeply, if it's deeply democratic, then it'll be quite natural to think of that, about that state or that polity as the people incorporated, you know, as a corporate entity. So that's where the sovereign is. And I think, sorry to go back, and this is going back a bit, what's wrong, or at least what's objectionable, in my view, in Hobbes and Buddha and Rousseau, is they all assume that the sovereign in a state has to be one particular entity within the state, the legislature, the administrator, the courts, or whatever. And of course, someone like Hobbes and Buddha make fun of the idea that you could have different sovereigns, as they say. And Rousseau makes a lot of fun of it when he says this is like the Japanese conjurer, you know, who throws an arm and a leg and a head into the air and then puts them together, says it's a single man. And that's just simply a mistake. There is a superordinate sovereign in any state that's a functional state, I would say. But it's the state itself. It's not any organ within it. And so it's quite consistent with having a sovereign state and satisfying in some ways the demands of sovereignty, a la Baudin and Hobbes and Rousseau, that you have actually a lot of internal conflict and separation and sharing of power within the state. And back to the US, I mean, it's certainly consistent with the federal system, you know, that may at times seem to be almost breaking apart, but eventually comes together, or with, you know, an election system that is so challenged that it's, you know, barely held in place. But, you know, God help us all if, so to speak, that falls away, you know. There's tension between the courts and the legislature, the administration, and so on. That's just part of the game in a democratic system, that you have that, you know. I mean, it's true that a place somewhere like China, you know, which is ruled more autocratically, it can achieve, you know, more oil, so to speak, in the wheels, more unity in that way, less friction. But boy, they pay a cost for that, which is, I think, that people know who the boss is, and they're certainly not part of the boss. Whereas, however friction-filled, you know, a country like the United States is, it's a system as a result in which people know where they stand, you know, and even if the system is creaking, so to speak, it still serves them well to that extent.
Yeah, I mean, what you're identifying is a, you know, it's a really important issue in thinking about those kind of centrifugal and centripetal forces in politics, integration and differentiation. Yes. And this is a perpetual tension in politics. And it's one that, I mean, it seems to me, I mean, a good insight of your book, which is, if you know, just give a broad overview, is to think about the a kind of dynamic relationship between these two things in all modern states. Now, it does seem to me this sort of notion of a sovereign as a kind of idea rather than an actual person. This is something I think that's difficult to sustain from a Hobbesian perspective. As somebody like Hobbes, I can understand why it's worrisome. Even the experiences in the United States over the past few years, and there was a Republican debate the other night, and Mike Pence stood up and said in the Republican debate, somebody like, Trump asked me to put myself over the Constitution. I chose the Constitution. That's a difficult thing for human beings to say when you are when the natural person is tempted by self-interest as over and against the kind of abstract fictional ideal. You know, it's certainly laudatory that Pence chose that, but it seems a difficult challenge, which makes me think, I mean, on your view, is it then better for modern states, if you're thinking about this sort of the integration versus differentiation, to lean more on the side of the Hobbesian side, more on the side of unification rather than differentiation? I'm thinking about your discussions about or your discussion about the parliamentary system versus the presidential system, for example. I'm not sure if you want to speak to that, but it seems to me that we want to lean a little bit more on the side of integration in modern states, on your view. Is that right?
I guess I agree with that, although I do want to stress that moving more towards integration and away from differentiation, as you're calling it, does not mean giving up on. Both parts there. I do actually think that the parliamentary system, and, you know, uniquely, I divide my life between Australia and America, who countries which are, I mean, they're very different in size and population and so on, but they're very, very nice match in terms of the both federal systems, the both common law systems, their whole range of ways in which they are similar, but they're different in one very deep respect, which is Australia's parliamentary system, whereas America is presidential. I do think that the parliamentary system, which does have lots of checks and balances, you know, sometimes it's a mistake to think it's only America has checks and balances. I mean, after all, the courts are independent of the politics. In fact, you know, I'd have to say intuitively much more independent of the politicians than in the United States. And similarly for all the various agencies that operate, and there are two houses, of course, of legislation and so on. But it's very much it's more integrated. And the reasons why I think that may operate better, and that's one of the things I do, it's a very tentative sort of sketch, that argument at the end of the third chapter. But yeah, entirely about the, as it were, how to make the functional state more functional, so to speak, in these ways with integration, differentiation, and integration mixed in this manner. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's also important that understanding what the state is enables us to think about the questions addressed in the last three chapters of the book, if you don't mind me intruding.
Please go ahead. I was worried looking at the time to but give us an overview. Yeah.
Well, just the first of all, there's the argument that that you get in Hobbes, probably not a very plausible argument nowadays, but it still has, there are traces of it left in constitutional theory, where people talk about constitutional paradoxes and so on. And the question is, how can ordinary people really ever be said to be in control of their state? Because they can only act together, their constitution and therefore their state, they can only act together under a constitution. But then how do they choose the constitution? You know, is there a sort of a circle here? And I argue very much that there's not, and that when Hobbes wants to argue that it was didn't make sense to talk about the people controlling the state or the citizenry, he's just wrong on that. That's not a limitation that's inherent in his way of thinking, or in my way of thinking for that matter. And then the last two chapters, the fifth chapter looks at, are there natural rights, you know, which before ever you get the theory of justice, it's just simply inconsistent with treating human beings as human beings. That is to say, as having the sort of rights we just take for granted, that we associate with autonomy and so on. Is a state simply inconsistent with treating human beings in that way? And I want to argue that it's not, and that a state is bound, if it's functional, actually to establish legally various rights that ought to keep people happy. But this is very different from a natural rights tradition, and it doesn't necessarily lead in the libertarian direction that, for example, Nozick uses the natural rights tradition to lead to. And then the final chapter is on the state and the economy. So can a functional state really assume control over the economy, or is there a constraint, which is a constraint of, so to speak, efficiency, that requires the state to stay out of the economy? I'm actually very taken by those issues, and I learned a lot, frankly, in working through the economic literature, the legal literature on that and so on. But I think that, and I look at property and money and corporations, and argue actually that as a matter of history, recent history in particular, the state plays a vital role in sustaining those three, so to speak, legs of any economy, property, money, and corporations as the players, so to speak, in the economy. And that to think that the state should be regarded as just an intruder in this domain, where it has to keep hands off if the system is going to work properly, the economy is going to work properly, is just simply a mistake. There's one element, though, that I think I should have probably given more attention to, though I do mention it, which is consistently with the view I argue for, you might think that the government of the day ought to be limited in how far it can, so to speak, intervene in the economy from, you know, day by day, so to speak, changing the policies of previous governments and so on, adjusting all of the time. That can create a real instability that is surely dysfunctional. And that's consistent, I think, with the state-centered view of the economy that I argue for in that chapter.
Good, yeah. And I wish we had all the time in the world to talk about those last three chapters. But just to conclude, let me ask you, finally, I mean, you started out the conversation by discussing your motivation and the early Trump administration and so forth. What do you think that the main lessons are from your book for contemporary politics? That, or maybe to put it in a kind of fun way, you know, if the Biden administration were to call you up on the phone, maybe they already have, I don't know, and ask you, you know, what kind of reform should we make to the American state or to the Australian state? What would you say?
Well, there are changes that I think would be very much for the best that are just simply not feasible. We can't get there from here. So, for example, as I've suggested already, and as you mentioned, I do think a parliamentary system offers a much better chance of a smoothly functioning state that still preserves that sort of sharing and separating of powers, you know, that's important from the point of view of those in the state itself. Not going as far as that. I mean, are there other elements? Well, I do think that having a different system for the appointment to the courts would surely be worth thinking about as to, you know, whether we could devise some system, you know, of, it needn't be a radical revision of the Constitution that's involved in doing that. You know, it could be simply establishing constitutionally, in consistency with the Constitution, various advisory bodies, for example, or independent bodies to, from the point of view of the Senate, you know, where these bodies really do have a sort of credibility, or a body like this has real credibility in giving advice, for example, on different appointments to the, say, the Supreme Court, where it might, you know, vet, so to speak, a series of candidates proposed by a president, rank them, and then hand it over to the Senate to judge between them. Well, you know, once you get recommendations and arguments like that, it gets to be harder to be just a rank political partisan in the debate. Now, I may be wrong about that. I may be completely wrong about that. But it strikes me something like that. And those with, see, I don't have the expertise. You know, as I said, doing a theory of justice, like a Republican theory of justice, I think, but involves, so to speak, various bodies of expertise. And that's one case. Another case where I do feel our system seems to have led to very dysfunctional results is in criminal justice, where it seems to me pretty clear that it's very difficult for politicians to respond in what I think of as a long-term sensible way to issues of what sentences should attach to different sorts of crimes. If whenever there's an atrocity, you know, and there always will be various crimes, the politician can be asked, you know, on the for the headline, you know, for the quick quip on what should we do about this? Because politicians are always going to say we should be tough on crime, you know, which is the emotional reaction we all have to an abhorrent crime. And the only way to respond politically for these poor people in our legislature is to adopt that stance. And that stance can lead, as I think it has led, you know, perhaps since the Dukakis-Bush debate back in 1978, you know, when Bush accused Dukakis of being soft on crime, because even though Massachusetts was doing better and better and better, certainly better than many other states in matters of crime, one particular offender who had been allowed out, I think, for his mother's funeral, committed a heinous offense while doing so. And that single event, you know, seems to have propelled this mania for tough on crime, tough on crime, tough on crime, to the point where we have far too many prisons, we have far too many people in prison. It's costing massively too much. You know, it's more expensive to keep someone in prison, apparently, than to send them to university to be trained. That is a crazy aspect of our system. Now, how might you benefit that, how might improve that? Well, I've argued this in the past, actually, but again, it's a philosopher's sort of suggestion. I lack the institutional expertise to really see how it might operate, but why not have an independent, at arm's length sort of body that recommends on criminal sentencing policy, as we have, for example, a Fed, you know, a central bank that recommends and makes decisions on interest rates and so on. Why not have such a body? And when there is an awful crime and people complain to the politicians could say, yes, I absolutely agree, and I'm writing a really strong letter to this body about how they must take account of this. And this body, which might represent ordinary people and various sectors of expertise in the society, can take time and look at the statistics about whether this or that lessening of a sentence, for example, led to an increase in crime or whatever, and can give advice on these matters, you know, which advice would not be binding on the legislature, but it would have a powerful effect, I think, in cueing the legislature to go in a certain direction. They'll be able to defend themselves by saying, we're going at the best advice we have. That's another sort of area. If I can mention a final device, which has been tried by other people, invented by other people, is, of course, the Citizens' Assembly. Now, in my own native Ireland, you know, that has worked extraordinarily well, paired with referenda, you know, where there's a Citizens' Assembly of statistically selected members over a long period who look at an issue and give advice on it, which advice is public. And then there's a referendum. And I think that really has led to a series of referenda where I would say they've been more thoughtful than referendums generally are. And they haven't been captured by special interests in the way in which referenda often are, especially citizen-initiated referenda. So you asked me a big question, what would I do? Well, these are just a few top of the head ideas, Jeff. I'm sorry not to be able to give you a slate of proposals for them, and nirvana follows. It's a real illusion, isn't it, to think of the state, to think of there being a steady state, you know, like it's an illusion economics to think there's a steady state, the perfect economy that will work without friction and so on. Same is true of democracy or of any state where there is a separation of power and so on. It's going to be mayhem a lot of the time. Well, maybe hopefully not mayhem exactly, but it's going to involve a lot of friction. And we have to live with that and almost glory in that, you know, as in this is how we do things. And this is actually for the common good ultimately, that you can have these dissident, you know, voices, this cacophony, so to speak, of voices, where ultimately, though, there is a mode of decision making that people fall in line with. That's why elections are so important. That's a case where people have got to fall in line with whatever is electorally supported. And that's what worries me terribly about the problem, which is on our hands just now as we approach the next election.
Yeah. Well, thank you for all that. This has been really enjoyable conversation, Philip. So let me thank you once again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Pleasure to be here. And thanks, Jeff, for giving me such time. I'm sorry for talking as much as I did.
That was always great. You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.